I had to.
Marine.
Yeah.
I'm so meaner.
Okay.
Can you repeat the fact?
Yeah.
It's okay,
can you make this bigger and more obvious? No, I'm excited to be here, and I was really excited that this is a conference that is not just aimed at academics, because I'm coming sort of back to academia after a varied history. I did a bachelor's degree back in the 80s. At Simon Fraser in the days of the general strike and all sorts of exciting stuff happening, but I did not fit into the culture of the university very well. When you have long hair and a black leather jacket and have little respect for most of your professors, they don't help you move along the academic path. But that's fine. That would not have fit me anyway at that point. I've worked as a printer, mechanic, house builder, and selling sex toys in the meantime. And I'm coming back to do a degree in sociology. I'm halfway through my master's degree. And my topic is punk, which is the scene I came out of in Vancouver. I'm Vancouver born and bred. And in the late 70s, there was this development of as you may or may not know, a sort of punk music started in New York. See if I can make this. Yeah, in the early 70s, these are some of the bands that were involved. They in turn influenced a movement in England, which this was largely a reaction to the corporatization of music. And not just rock, but any type of music. By the early 70s, bands had become one with very, very large corporations, and there was very little room for local music to happen, even. There's the age of stadium rock and this kind of stuff, so if you were going to put on a concert, it had to be bring in $1 million, basically, which in the 70s was a lot of money, so maybe not so much now. But in Vancouver, there was quite an interesting scene. I mean, one of the things, just coming here, I realized how isolated Vancouver is. It's a very different culture from central Canada, the rest of Canada. I can even tell from, I've noticed street names and stuff like this. They're very different here as opposed to Vancouver. I recognize them because we get Government of Canada propaganda that has these names and stuff like this. But, you know, for us, it's a different country in some ways. So, and that's reflected culturally in the music scene that happened. And one of the interesting things about the Vancouver scene, it actually kind of originated in Victoria with the band The Dish Rags, which was an all-women's band. So, it's kind of ironic because the history of punk is often seen as a very sort of masculine form of music, and what I'm researching actually is specifically women involved in the scene, because I kind of got a little I was doing some reading in the area, and there was a fellow in England who researched older punk rock fans, and he went to bars and he interviewed people who identified as punk and were still going to see punk music and stuff like this. And then he ended his essay by saying, you know, it would have been really interesting to talk to women, but I couldn't find any. And I thought, well, you know, this is a classic lesson in research. You know, where were you looking, you know, for women in their late 40s and 50s? So in cheap bars in England, you weren't going to find them there. But fortunately for me, coming out, you know, I've maintained contact with a lot of these people, so I can... I can find them. They're there. So they were present. More than present, they in fact instigated a lot of the music and a lot of the fashion and stuff that came with it. I mean, that's the other thing I know from being there is that, the classic joke, what do you call a musician without a girlfriend? Homeless. Because women financed a lot of this musical production. They taught the bands how to put on makeup and do their hair and, you know, make all the styles that became the punk style, but it was the sort of male-dominated bands that got all the press out of it. So the Vancouver scene also, because Vancouver is fairly isolated, it was a combination of a lot of different types of music. So what I had previously here was a list of, go back, there we go. These would be conventional sort of punk bands, loud, aggressive, fast music. There was also a number of more poppy bands that could have had commercial potential, could have got radio airplay, sometimes did get local radio airplay. The local music scene was strongly supported by campus radio. We had co-op radio, CFRO, which is a cooperatively run radio station, but almost no commercial support whatsoever. So the scene was essentially entirely non-commercial, and not necessarily by choice of the bands. Some of them would have liked to make money. And there was some stuff that was deliberately non-commercial, more sort of art project-based. Bands like UJ3RK5 were pronounced U-Jerks. Their hit song was U-Jerks Work for the Police. Did not make them popular. No Fun was a band based in Surrey, which is south of Vancouver. Is not renowned as a cultural hotspot. So... And they made fun of everything. Some people considered them the most punk rock band that ever existed. So, more for their attitude and the fact that they refused to be commercial. They did things like we have the Vancouver Folk Festival. It's a big deal in Vancouver, and they put on the Vancouver Folk Festival for rich people because they argued that rich people have culture too, and it should be celebrated. So that's sort of the essential punk rock attitude. Part of what happened was a huge profusion. This is just a small selection of the independently released. All of these are independently released, and they're just a portion of what was released over a few years period. The big album there, No Exit, that is made by hand. It's photocopied from a Damned cover, I think. The backside is Clash cover, sorry, and the backside is photocopied from a Damned cover, and they cut out their own heads and pasted them on top and then photocopied them again and spray-painted the No Exit logo and sold that. I met one of the guys in the band when I went to a concert, and he was selling his album for $2.99, and he had a pocket full of pennies. Because he insisted on giving you the penny, because he said, I refuse to make a penny off of this. This is a non-commercial venture. Inside was a sheet of paper basically saying, this is not part of a multi-million-dollar machine. We refuse to make money. Music shouldn't be. So you might say a strong political message. And not just in the writing, but in the very action. Everything was handmade, and he would not take more money than it cost him to make. Not all bands had that attitude, but it was present and very conscious. So, and it was also reflected in literature, fanzines, all sorts of what I call ephemera, the various written pieces that came out around the same time, around concerts and... around concerts and various other events that were put on. I mean, amongst them, my first exposure to the Vancouver punk scene was, where is it? There it is. Rock Against Radiation, which was an all-ages outdoor gig. One of those bands is a reggae band. The other... Pointed Sticks are sort of a poppy band. The K-Tells were a pop band that got sued by the K-Tell Corporation, and the other two were punk bands. So a combination of musical forms uniting around a certain political agenda. And also, it was very important that this was all ages. It was designed to appeal to as many different, and free. So it was designed to appeal to as many different people as possible. And we were talking earlier in a session about how to appeal to a wide variety of people. Well, make it free and accessible and fun. So is one way of doing it. So the context of the time, BC, I mean, I think this sort of stuff, obviously, not just in BC, but we had extremely right-wing government come in and starting government funding. It was the beginnings of the implementations of a neoliberal agenda, essentially. We have an organization called the Fraser Institute in BC. They advised the government on cutting back the amount. Well, they say they're cutting back the amount of government, but they end up spending more money. But they fired, I think, 25% of all government workers in one day. They just made an announcement, said 25% of you are gone. We'll figure that out in the next couple of weeks. Who's gone? So, but it kind of made for a very dramatic couple of years. But there was other scenes already happening there. There was a well-established anarchist scene publishing. Newspaper Open Road magazine was fairly well-known. A busy local music scene, pop, rock, all sorts of stuff, had been going on since the 60s at least. And one of the things I've noted as being quite important was a welfare system that could actually pay people enough so that they could have time to do other stuff, which is not, of course, the purpose of welfare, but I think we need to recognize that it's very helpful to have a welfare system that allows people to not work. So, because it's all been replaced by this sort of this idea that everyone should work, and that if they're on welfare, it's because they're not working enough. And we have a workfare. I mean, we even have it at SFU. We have a form of workfare. We have a bursary available. It's called a work study that if you qualify for it, which means your income is too low, you don't have enough funding to go to school, they will allow you to work for $10 an hour, which is, of course, far below what anyone else at the university earns. And but that's the neoliberal agenda taken into the university, and that's how it works. So we are now give people in BC, the welfare rate is about $525, I think, currently. You can't rent a one-bedroom apartment, really, for less than $800. So, you know, what are we doing there? That's why I refer to, I mean, Vancouver has become one of the sort of the great neoliberal cities of the world, because the distance between the rich and the poor has become completely untenable. They're simply, they don't even see it anymore. The physical distance isn't necessarily there, but the distance of knowledge and experience and, the rich simply, the powerful people have no connection at all, no understanding. There's not even an attempt anymore to justify what they do and when they cut back social services and stuff. They just don't care. And they make that really clear. One of the ways they've made that clear lately is by cuts of up to 90% in cultural funding. They've had to rescind some of these, because they actually contravened contracts they entered into and law that existed. I don't know how to move forward on. Somewhere I have a chart. Just a moment.
It's showing 17 slides, so that's the last one.
Yeah, okay.
Is
oh, well.
Somewhere else?
Yeah,
Oh,
there it is. But I don't know why. Oh, huh.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's block out here. This is a chart of, you can see, I mean, BC was at less than half of any other province, and we are now going to less than a quarter. And this is after they backtracked. So, and again, I think it's important to recognize that this sort of funding, arts funding, is because arts are not a commercial venture. This is important at a social level. So that eliminating arts funding, which is essentially what they're trying to do, and I don't know of any other government in Canada that's considering this, but it is part of the neoliberal ideals that the Fraser Institute put forward, is that there should be no government funding. The purpose of government is not to do any arts funding or really any social services. So BC is becoming an exemplar of where other provinces may be heading if they decide that that this sort of model is workable, if they get away with it. So I contend and I hope that cultural work can act as a focus of resistance. And part of what I base that on, I mean, I have some theoretical background. The theory I'm using is centered around Pierre Bourdieu's theories of habitus and cultural capital, where habitus basically is sort of, it helps define the limits of what people are able to do and think. And so if we can't see our way out, we won't be able to act our way out. So, but if we can see, and I think that's what culture helps do, is allow us to see other options. And punk culture specifically is sort of an extreme form of that. One of the interesting things about punk culture, it gave rise to all sorts of very, very sort of radical talk and some radical action. As some of you know the history, there was one of the bands, the Subhumans, the bass player served several years for blowing up a BC Hydro substation, Litton Industries here in Ontario, I think. And that's one example of the more extreme combination of action and talk. DOA, one of the longest running bands, one of their slogans is talk minus action equals zero. So action is an important part of that. You don't have to blow things up, but it's not necessarily a bad idea. But it's certainly important to at least consider that as a plausible form of political action. So, because if you don't consider it, then you don't sort of consider the full range. And just because you talk about something doesn't mean you have to do something. And what we're seeing now is a restriction of culture, a sort of restriction of knowledge and a restriction of options that means we're not talking about all sorts of possible things that could be done to change things. So, and in BC specifically, what little arts funding they're offering, they're trying to direct towards what they're calling spirit festivals, which may sound all very nice and sort of First Nations friendly and this sort of stuff, except it's based on glorification of the recent Olympics that we had, which served to, again, take money from the poor and give it to the powerful. And the pro-government spirit that they tried to put forward, that this was a very successful Olympics and this sort of stuff, which on the ground, it was not for most of the people that lived there. It cost a huge amount of money. There's all sorts of legacies that are not very nice for the people who are now living in that province. So the continuation, I mean, what's happened now, we continue to have punk music. In BC, at least, that's what I know. And it continues to be underground, and I think there's good reasons for that. There's things within it, within the base politics of punk, that allow it this sort of continued resistance. And one of those things is the sort of DIY, do-it-yourself ethos behind it. It's like, if you have to depend on a large corporation to do it, don't do it. It's not an effective action. Low cost, it should be accessible to as many people as possible. And the same with the all ages thing. It's like, why do we divide things up so that only people of certain ages can go? Or even, I mean, and that does not necessarily about the law, it's about excluding oftentimes older people. So the punk gigs and stuff now are interesting because it's not about a sort of youth subculture necessarily. And oftentimes musical movements are seen as really focused on young people. And why would that be? I mean, I guess now getting a little bit older, I know music is still important to me, and it still informs how I think of things. And so it's important that be open to that. And that, in turn, means it works at a community level. It's not necessarily about making money at a national level or anything like this. So, and it's multifaceted. It's not just about music. It's about the way we look, dress, the material we read, and all sorts of art projects focused around punk. Punk gigs would happen in art galleries, for instance. Art students and stuff would be involved. It's about mixing all sorts of different aspects of the community together, and yet it maintains a sort of identifiable aspect. You may not be able to define punk directly, but you know it's there. And so people can identify, and two people from different places can say, yeah, I listen to punk. I like that. And sort of that's a commonality that can work around perhaps economic differences or social differences that would otherwise exist. And maybe that's, well, I think that's important in both small communities and big communities, because those divisions exist in different ways in different types of communities. Something like punk, which can be adopted or not, can transcend some of those. So the drawbacks are that it's not necessarily doesn't necessarily appeal to a lot of people. It's not a way to make money. It's not a way to support yourself. So, and again, this goes back to the sort of greater social problems of how people get enough money to live on. And unfortunately, what happened in Vancouver, there was a big influx of the illegal drug trade that was used to make money to support the music. And the consequence was a lot of deaths in the music scene. So that's sort of something to be wary of within any sort of countercultural movement. Or I don't necessarily like that term, but within any oppositional movement. And I mean, around the same time, I knew people who were working down in San Francisco, and whenever any large group of people would start to organize some resistance, the streets would be flooded with all sorts of illegal drugs readily available at low prices. So it was part of the state's way of managing resistance, so because it makes resistance awfully difficult. So, but nonetheless, it's fun, I find, I still. It's a way of maintaining resistance. Because if maintaining that resistance is not fun, you just end up being miserable. And that's not why any of us, that is not the point of political change, to make more people miserable. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. And that's why I think culture is so important to any of this sort of political work. And that's it.
Talk a bit and then play the clip. Okay. Part way through.
So next up we have Candace.
Hi, everyone. I'm Candace, and I'm going to talk about community radio as a tool for organizing social change. I have been involved in community-based radio for about 15 years. I started off in Fredericton, New Brunswick at CHSR-FM, where I hosted a punk show for 10 years. And then...
Yuck!
And then I ended up in Halifax at CKDU, which is the campus radio station based at Dalhousie University, and I worked there as the news and spoken word coordinator for a few years, and that's where I got involved with the Halifax Coalition Against Poverty and their radio program called HCAP Radio. And now I am at CHRY in Toronto, which is based at York University, where I'm involved in a news collective there. But mainly I'm going to talk about my time in Halifax at CKDU working with HCAP Radio. The Halifax Coalition Against Poverty very similar to the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty in terms of mandate and strategy, I would say. HCAP was definitely a younger organization. They'd only been around for a couple of years, and I know OCAP has been around for about 20. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary this November. So HCAP Radio was a radio program that aired every 2 weeks. On Friday afternoons, it was a half hour long, 5:30 p.m., which is like drive time, you know, like sweeter slots on the airwaves. And the point of the show is mainly to provide a forum for poor people and their allies to share their experiences and their struggles around poverty. It was used as an advocacy tool, largely informed by the advocacy committee branch of HCAP, where people would drop in and talk about how they were being screwed over by landlords and were presented with different options on how HCAP could support them. And so it was the advocacy work that HCAP was doing that informed that part of the radio program. And programmers involved with HCAP Radio also reported on poverty issues from an HCAP perspective, meaning that they often embraced an anti-capitalist politic and embraced direct action tactics, which was not the kind of reporting that you would read in the Halifax Chronicle, for example. So the show did discuss confronting politicians and policymakers. The program did openly denounce and name landlords, so it was a very unapologetic program, really pushing a lot of legal boundaries. It was very much supported by the radio station, so that was really important. Just to give you a taste, because it's kind of strange to talk about radio and not play some audio, this is a piece that aired following a direct action when HCAP stormed the annual general meeting of a particular politician in the riding of Chester. She was the Minister of Community Services, and so in a lot of ways could be held responsible for a lot of the conditions that people were living in and struggling in.
Money's acting specially, and that money's
audio from an action. So the show, was very raw, very angry, very raw. And there was often very little editing. So speakers were provided with plenty of time. You know, it wasn't about capturing a sound bite. So, you know, in addition to pushing kind of legal boundaries, they're also pushing kind of, you know, journalistic standards. You know, there was no sense of let's be objective about this. You know, we know which side we're on, and that's the side we're going to present. Sometimes there would be swearing on the show. It would not be cut out. Swearing, some F-bombs here and there. And the point was to depict societal reality. And people were angry, you know, and I think that's okay. We shouldn't tiptoe around people's anger, especially in the face of economic violence, as this panel suggests. There was maybe one slick production that was produced by HCAP Radio, and it was a 30-minute documentary around the Special Diet campaign. So again, this was a project that was informed by the advocacy committee of HCAP, where people were coming in and saying that they were having trouble accessing special diet monies for people who were on welfare or disability. It was an extra stipend, you know, if, for example, you had diabetes or something and, you know, wanted to access nutritional food, nutritious food. You know, everyone needs access to nutritious food. So that was a campaign that HCAP took on. So that kind of served more of an educational purpose. And it was also an outreach project in the community. I can talk a bit about you know, different actions that HCAP engaged in. I'm not really sure what people are interested in. We didn't really do a go-around asking what people's projects are and where your interests are at. And I think the most important thing is that HCAP Radio was very much grounded in local social movements. Like, that's where the momentum was at the time. HCAP, in its heyday, had very strong political support. You know, you really only needed to threaten an action for a change to occur. So, for example, someone approached HCAP and after going through, you know, a legal process, they weren't seeing any results. And so, you know, they would come to HCAP for extra legal support. You know, if often we don't have recourse to other, you know, to legal options, you know, it's such an uphill battle, and often the odds are stacked against you. You know, the Residential Tenancies Act is very much in favor of protecting property, usually, and less so about protecting tenants. So they would approach HCAP, and we would work with people. And so, yeah, in this one instance, we just needed to threaten action against a particular business because the landlord in question was the owner of that business. And, it was announced on the radio, and then that he paid up, finally. He owed the tenant some amount of money. So that was an example of how the radio program was successful in making a wee difference in one person's life, you know, or a big difference in their life. So it was very much grounded in local social movements. Yeah, there was a lot of HCAP radio could be used as a rallying point for mobilizing our collective political power in the face of people who might have more economic power in our communities. And also, I think it's important to note that HCAP radio is very complementary to a lot of the other work that HCAP was doing, and you know, and similar like-minded organizations. HCAP published a zine called Dignity Through Resistance. HCAP housed the People's Photocopier, so people could publish other literature. There was often a team who screen printed posters using the local screen printing cooperative across the street. I mean, it was a really small community, and there were definitely other outreach strategies that were employed. I'll leave it at that, and I'm totally willing to answer questions if you have them when we're done. Short and sweet. Oh, and I have copies of the academic paper that I wrote about HCAP radio, where I interview some of the hosts, where they talk about how they negotiated, you know, like being newsiness, like let's report on things now as they're happening, and how to present also kind of like a longer-term vision of how we want to live our lives. We're supporting each other in a community. So how do we constantly keep in mind like our anti-capitalist politics when we're presenting news? So I have copies of them here. Mm-hmm.
Hello. There we go. So this is what I'm here to talk about, CKUT's Homelessness Marathon. It's not just CKUT's Homelessness Marathon. I was almost going to try to remember to tell Christiana not to introduce it that way because it's broadcast on more than 40 stations around the country, but CKUT predominantly does put together a large majority of it. So it's not a wrong title. It's just a misleading title. As was said, my name's Gretchen. I just want to tell you a little bit about how I came to this concept of like poverty in the media. Actually, I was walking around in Chicago and bumped into somebody selling a street newspaper, and that was my first encounter with this notion of poor and homeless people actually produce media. Wow. And then when I was in Chicago because I was moving to Seattle. It was a layover in Chicago on the train. And when I got to Seattle, I found the street newspaper and had often purchased it and was part of that while I was in school, like reading it, following it. It was a very great newspaper because it didn't just cover, you know, poor issues of poor and homeless people, but it also had radical and progressive perspectives on all sorts of things happening in the city. So it was a great resource. And then when I finished school, I was like, wow, what am I going to do now? So I went to like the internship database at the university I was at and saw that they were actually hiring an unpaid intern volunteer position at the local street newspaper. So I was like, great, you know, let's apply and see what happens. And I was the first person to apply and the first person to be interviewed and the person to be hired. So it was great. And it was my first experience working in any kind of media project was at the street newspaper. So my eyes really opened up the first time I walked in the office to even do the interview. There was an elderly gentleman who I just passed on the street who was spare changing with a sign that was like homeless vet, you know, spare change appreciated. And he walked in the Real Change office and he saw me sitting there and he was like, you're too young to be here, meaning I'm too young to be a street vendor for a street newspaper. I should, you know, have someone to take care of me. And I looked at him and I'm like, you're too old to be here, you know? Like, what are you talking about? So that's basically how I got involved in this notion of media produced by and for homeless people, was that I worked in the street newspaper as an editorial assistant, helping people write copy, helping people write editorials, which sometimes meant they sat there and dictated to me while I typed because I was a good typist. And then we'd sit together and kind of reformulate ideas. But then I also got involved in indie media. The year was 1999. The WTO, World Trade Organization, had come to Seattle. The Independent Media Center set up. I was part of that in setting up a webcasting station, also pirate radio activities that were happening in and around Seattle during the time. And one of the things that happened due to that media movement to cover the WTO was that that media organization, the IMC, stuck around Seattle and actually became a resource to people in Seattle. And so one of the resources that got one of the groups that started to use the resource of the IMC and the webcasting station that specifically I started working with as a volunteer coordinator was the street newspaper's poets. So the street newspaper, in addition to having news and information, also had a literary section. And so those poets started doing a program called Street Voices on the Air. And it was really one of these amazing programs where in our tiny little studio, which was smaller, about half the size of this table, literally, that was the size of our studio. So comfortably, you could have two people in there. They would come with a crowd of 12 and have to use the studio with the door open. And we were like basically in a closet off an office. So we would sort of, we scheduled programs like that had too many people to come in on the weekend. Anyway, so they would get on the air and you would have a multitude of voices doing their poetry and loving it. And the fact that pirates picked it up and rebroadcasted it meant they were on the FM dial. It was really awesome. So Street Voices on the Air, that was a program I was involved with. Anyway, so this whole participation and emphasis in poverty programming at Studio X, as that webcasting station was called, my experience at the street newspaper Real Change in Seattle, all of that led me to be really interested in making sure the margins of our society have a space in the media where which they can represent themselves. So when I moved out to the East Coast, one of the projects I got involved with was the Homelessness Marathon. Now the Homelessness Marathon started by a radio programmer in upstate New York. He had a radio show like anybody. I think he was doing like a regular news program, but was particularly concerned by the absence of discussions of poverty and homelessness in the media. Just like here in Canada, there's no focus, there's no attention. You know, yes, there's HCOP radio, yes, there's the Homelessness Marathon, but beyond that, when we talk about the mainstream media, when we talk about what the corporate media is doing, when we talk about what the CBC is doing, when do they even talk about the perspectives of poor people? Maybe around Christmas time. And that's kind of the exact goal of the Homelessness Marathon is we don't do it around Christmas time because we don't want to feed into that poverty industry of just throw a little money and it'll go away. So he decided to start, this guy's name's Jeremy Alderson, there's actually a quote from him here on the front page, ending homelessness is not a matter of charity, but a matter of changing the way our society is structured. So he started a radio program that broadcasts from sunset to sunrise. He did it the first year just on his local station in upstate New York in Waterloo. I don't know if you guys know where this is. It's not far from the border. Anyway, he started it basically as a way to talk about the structural issues of poverty and homelessness, to make a space for poor and homeless people to come and speak about their experiences, to talk about the multitude of perspectives that exist when it comes to being poor in the States. So what I did in terms of my involvement with that program was help them start webcasting. Webcasting is basically radio on the internet. Radio on the internet became a great way to cheaply distribute radio programming because the way the CBC does it, the way National Public Radio in the States do it, is they either have fancy lines that you have to pay $5,000 to install or they use satellite networks. So what are poor community stations going to do? They're going to use internet, or pirate stations, as I was involved with, we're going to use internet to distribute things around freely. So we got the U.S. Homelessness Marathon on the internet, and when I moved to Canada, I was visiting here quite a bit because the Summit of the Americas was happening in Quebec City, and I helped to set up an independent media center there. And in coming through Montreal, I was meeting a lot of very great radical people, but I was also meeting people who were involved in a squat that was happening that summer after the Summit of the Americas. There was a squat that was taken over not far from Concordia University, right in the downtown core of Montreal, called the Overdale Squat. And it had a lot of popular support. It had support from the neighbors who were bringing water and supplies to the squatters. It even got to be an issue in the mainstream media because it was election season, and the media loves to like throw hot issues at the people running and say, hey, what do you think, and try to create division and I don't know, all of that stuff. So it became, you know, the issue of the day is what are you going to do with the squatters, the current mayor, and if you, the running candidate against this person, were mayor, what would you do, you know? So basically what ended up happening is that the city negotiated the Overdale squatters to move to another building, which was a city building, which was also abandoned, called Prefontaine. And basically the squatters ended up there for a couple months. And again, coming up to Montreal, because I was living in upstate New York, it wasn't that far. And I fell in love with Montreal pretty much after my first visit, so I wanted to be there a lot, and pretty much decided I wanted to move there. So I was visiting frequently, and was often staying in Prefontaine squat when I came, and had developed relations with some of the squatters, became good friends, and also heard a lot of their concerns about their representation in the media, and also heard a lot of their concerns about how the police and fire department and the city were harassing them and intimidating them and basically threatening to kick them out. And every night it seemed like there was going to be an attack. And every night people were running up to the top of the building to like strategize and do we make Molotovs and what do we do and so on and so forth. So, you know, there was this big kind of criticism of what the mainstream media in Montreal, what their focus was, what their attention was, how they were spinning the story and how the squatters were constantly portrayed as not deserving, as opposed to having a right, right? So there's a big difference. And you often see that in the mainstream media. So essentially there was a bit of a promise between me and the squatters that I would do whatever it takes to make sure that they get media space within where the station that I started working at, CKUT. So when I got started working at CKUT, it was December. The Homelessness Marathon generally runs in January or February. It was way too soon to run the first marathon, that, you know, January, February 2002 when I started working there. So we ran the first one in January 2003. And it was again on this promise to the squatters that they would have space, and they came out in force. Like, all of the squatters who had been involved in Prefontaine and Overdale came out and they took space in the marathon. And in fact, some of the city officials that we had invited to participate in the marathon, not to give them a spotlight, not to give them a platform, but to get them to discuss the issues of concern with the squatters on equal levels, right? You're actually going to discuss things with these people as opposed to have your say, and then we'll have let the squatters have their say, so that there's no actual dialogue, or, you know, nobody attacks anybody. That's not the format of the Homelessness Marathon. And we did have a city official call in. We had been trying to get the mayor of Montreal to join the Homelessness Marathon that first year, and, you know, kept getting no answer. Like, the answer that we would get would be like, we'll call you back. And then the night of the marathon, the city's attaché for housing, like the person who holds that dossier, actually called in. So there was this really intense debate with the squatters, which involved like the squatters yelling into a speakerphone, because that was the system that we had for broadcasting phone calls. So literally we were set up outside on the streets with a speakerphone and a microphone hanging over it, and like the squatters are all around the speakerphone yelling at the city attaché, and then like he's like kind of yelling back at them. Anyway, it's great radio because it's the reality, right? People are angry, people are upset, and that's what needs to be broadcast. We don't need civilized dialogue when what's happening is not civilized. So anyway, to just give you a sense of what the marathon looks like, because I'm talking about it and can't really see it. There's a couple movies that are uploaded. I just wanted to draw your attention to the web address here, because I'm going to not talk so much so we can have a little bit of time for discussion. And I know I took some time from the panel. But if you look at the top here, we're at ckut.ca/hm for Homelessness Marathon /blog. You can get this. The whole archive of the marathon, so the last 8 years, are all available online. There's two movies that have been made. There's photos. Even last year's marathon is available for download here. There's a lot of data. If you know anyone who's interested in researching poverty and homelessness in Canada, there's a lot of rich data available here on the Homelessness Marathon, essentially unfiltered, some F-bombs too, now and again. You know, conversations, experiences, voices, perspectives of what it is to be poor and homeless in Canada. So this is the first movie. I'm just going to play it very brief. I should probably do this.
Why it's so important to have a Canadian Homelessness Marathon is simply because homeless people do not have access to the media.
So now we're up to 40 stations.
CSW from the University of Calgary, or maybe you're listening to CSUV from the University of Victoria. So we have people everywhere listening to us. I hope you're enjoying the show. We still have 13 more hours to go.
Wonderful opportunity to be able to take to the airwaves like this across the country and do a nationwide broadcast, because it really demonstrates that this is a social issue, that this is something that touches us from coast to coast, and that this is something that all of our communities should be talking about.
So I just want to play you a few clips from the second marathon as well, or it's the second movie. So The first video you saw was filmed outside of Café sur la Rue. Café sur la Rue was one of these great institutions started by homeless people who were like, we need a place to go where we can buy a cup of coffee for 25 cents and get a sandwich for a dollar. So they created like a little cafe where they could do that kind of thing. And this is still when you could smoke inside during the day. And what was nice is that, the Homelessness Marathon, we set up all the microphones and the table and the speaking. Everything happens outside, but inside is where the board is. So there are a lot of people, volunteers, running from CKDD to help tech the marathon because they could smoke cigarettes and tech at the same time, which doesn't happen now because you can't do that anymore. Anyway, so now we're at the Native Friendship Center, and we've been there for 5 years. The weather's always crappy.
So I want to welcome everyone who's listening to the third annual edition of the Homelessness Marathon, a chaotic start as usual as we're coming to you from the icy, snowy streets of frozen Montreal. I'd like to introduce our listeners to a caller that we have on the line. We have Joe Fontana, who's a Minister of Labor and Homelessness in Canada. Joe Fontana, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for doing this. Well, there's no doubt that, in fact, housing is a basic need, because there's some people that are paying 40, 50, 80% of their income towards housing. And so you're absolutely right. It is a basic need. It's not a privilege. All kinds of people need choices, and not only with the homeless, but those at risk of being homeless, but more importantly also is help those families and people that are looking for affordable housing.
Much agreed here at the Homelessness Marathon, this marathon making space for homeless voices for the next 14 hours. I want to thank Minister Fontana for joining us.
So that was the minister's response to the question of, is housing a human right? This is the basic stance of the Homelessness Marathon, is that housing is a human right. And you saw how he kind of twisted that around and didn't really answer the question, as politicians are so good at. I just wanted to mention, Candace had mentioned HCAP Radio exists to confront the policies and the policymakers, and that is one of the goals of the Homelessness Marathon. And I know that 1 year we probably got someone fired in the federal government because we had Monty Solberg on. And he had basically agreed to come and speak for 5 minutes, and then he wanted to go off air. Everybody knows Monty Solberg. He's from Ontario. He was part of the, I think he was responsible. There's a dossier in the government for labor and housing, and it's nothing. It's like it gets a little bit of money, and I think they do research with it. So he was on that dossier, and he had joined us on the phone, and he did not expect to have a conversation, i.e. we had people on the phone from Homes Not Homes.
Different group.
Yeah, exactly. That's that group in Vancouver,
yeah.
Right?
It's the government.
Yeah. So Homes Not Bombs and on, but we also had somebody on from Yellowknife, and these two people ripped new a-holes in Monty Solberg because he was there just to present stats and sort of wow everybody with the numbers, as politicians love to do. Like, we've thrown this much money here, and we've seen this percentage of increase there, and aren't you proud to be Canadian, and so on and so forth. And, the person on the phone from Yellowknife was like, I'm sorry, Minister, you've cut things for the last 3 years, and this is what the situation is in Yellowknife. And, the guy from Homes Not Bombs was really awesome, saying this much money is going to the war in Afghanistan. What are you going to do here, and so on and so forth. So politicians definitely get confronted on the Homelessness Marathon, and it's not our goal to, invite them every year, but the Homelessness Marathon is not just programmed by me. It's programmed by a collective of people. It's often volunteers from CKUT. It's often also street people themselves. We actually have a planning meeting coming up at the Native Friendship Center the first week of February, and we're calling around to all the different service organizations and reaching out to the network of people who have participated in the marathon over the year to come and join that meeting. So just to very quickly give you an idea of the nature of the marathon, but also to speak to the title of the panel here, resisting economic violence, I just want to point out that the marathon doesn't receive a permit. You saw that we basically squat the sidewalk, and we've never had a problem with the city. And I think it's one of these things of, like, collective action. Cops are afraid to touch. They're afraid to harass it, right? And whenever they see, like, a radio media thing happening, they're not going to come up and bust it up, right? Because it is live radio, and it's on 40-plus stations around the country. That's going to be broadcast live. We would certainly put a microphone in front of any baton and let that microphone get beat if a cop chooses to do that. So the marathon does not get a permit. It's a big deal to reclaim that public space and to put a microphone down and to amplify, not just at 5,000 watts on CKUT's transmitter, somebody's voice, you know, who lives on the streets or works on the streets of Montreal, but to actually broadcast it on 40-plus stations across the country. People say hi to friends and relations across Canada when they come on the marathon. there's an open mic that happens every year. Free form. People can say and do whatever they want. A lot of times it's music, a lot of times it's poetry, and sometimes it's just ranting. People got to take things off their chest. And if they want to do it on 40-plus stations, that's great. It might shock the community in Nanaimo when they hear some F-bombs from Montreal, but it's the reality, and I think people appreciate that. I want to get to playing one more audio clip from the first open mic, but just to mention some of the themes that we've dealt with. Again, if you go to the website, you can literally, all of these archives of the marathon list the themes and have it available for download. But some of the themes that we had, for example, are, you know, getting by, eating in the north and the south. A lot of the times when you think of Canada, we just think of southern Canada and we don't think of the north. And there's a huge distinction in terms of the reality of poverty in the north and in the south. I remember last year we had a panel looking at Indigenous experiences, comparing the difference in the north and the south. And Nunavut has a huge housing crisis due to overcrowding. One of the speakers was talking about the kind of violence that people experience in their lives, whether they're male, female, or a child growing up in Nunavut, and deducing that a lot of that violence is related to housing, overcrowding. Like, what are you going to do when you had a rough day at work and you come home and you've got like 15, you know, family members to deal with? You know, you might get a little freaky on people. It comes full circle, these issues, when we talk about housing. We've had critical reviews of shelters and services. So we've actually had people on the street who refuse to go into shelters coming up to the mic and speaking with people who run shelters about why they refuse to go into shelters. We've had people talk about, you know, some of the great shelters that exist. There's a shelter in Montreal Dans la Rue is a service in Montreal for youth, and they don't distinguish between servicing young men or young women. And it's the only space in Montreal that you can go to as, you know, say, a group of friends or a couple, and if it's mixed gender, you can go in together, as opposed to the other service organizations in Montreal where you actually have to separate. So that makes it very difficult for a homeless family, right? Like, what are you going to do when it's mom, dad, and a couple kids, and you need to go into a shelter for a night? You can't go to a family shelter. They don't exist. So the shelter services that exist are exclusive to gender. We've had panels that deal with gender on the street. So what happens when someone's trans? Do they have to dress differently to just get into a shelter that will service them? And there's a lot of complications there. We've had panels on working on the streets, just kind of to bust those myths that people aren't just spare changing on the street. There's all sorts of things that are happening on the street so that people can economically get by. We've had a lot. I remember the one year that I was helping with a panel and working on the street. There was a bit of a discussion that went off on a tangent about, are we talking about trying to get people off the street, or are we talking about trying to make a better experience for people in the street? And that's come up again and again in the marathon. There are tons of people who come to the microphone and who are proud to be in the street and who feel fulfilled by street culture, and they don't want to be anywhere else. I remember one year speaking to a 15-year-old who was like, I want everybody to come out here and be with me. I don't want to go and be housed. I want people to come and have this experience here because this is where I feel complete. And it's true. It should be valued and it should be allowed, and people should have a right to choose where they want to live. And if that means to live in the street, then they should be able to live there safely. You know, anyway, I could go on forever, but I do need to wrap up. So I just want to talk about some of the contributions of the marathon. We've definitely built a national platform for poor and homeless people. We've created community, at least in Montreal, around the Homelessness Marathon. We have people who come back year to year, people who are like, when's it happening? You know, they might see me in June or July and just like, oh, when's the marathon happening this year, you know? So there's definitely a sense of people want it, they want it to happen again and again. People who, you know, the squatters who participated in Overdale and Prefontaine, they often come back every year. The marathon's the kind of organic thing that happens that sometimes people call in just to say hi to each other. So it's not really a conversation. It's like, I just want to say hi to my friend who I hear on the radio, you know? And then also, this is spreading to other stations. And in the last couple of years, what we've done is invited campus community radio stations who normally just carry the marathon to also produce the marathon. So last year, we had CITR and Co-op Radio in Vancouver did a joint hour broadcasting poor and homeless artists. Which I think in BC is a very relevant issue. Mm-hmm. We also had Halifax do 5 hours last year. And then we also had an hour from CJAM, which is a joint presentation between the U.S. Marathon and the radio station in Windsor. And we also had an hour from Thunder Bay produced. So you get direct voices on the streets in those communities talking about what it is to be poor and homeless there. That always happens through a toll-free number you see here on the website. We advertise a toll-free number that people can call in through all night long. So I think I kind of talked about everything that I wanted to talk about. I just want to play one quick clip, which is the first call that we ever got on that speakerphone that we set up on the street for the Homelessness Marathon, the very first Homelessness Marathon.
We're going to have someone from
Toronto. We didn't know what was going to happen.
Toronto, I believe, who has composed a song about homelessness. It's something she's written herself. She's been performing on the air across Canada by telephone, if we can get her on the phone right now.
You're live on the Homelessness Marathon broadcasting coast to coast. It's okay. I can hear you fine. Can you introduce yourself?
De
Toronto?
Yeah.
Okay. And are you homeless yourself?
Well, I have to. That's what the song's about.
Well, let's hear it.
Somebody who used to live in Tent City in Toronto, which I don't know if people remember, was set up by Home Depot, got bulldozed by the city. And she literally called into the Homelessness Marathon with her phone to her ear and her guitar in hand and played this song, and it was the first call ever. The open mic is a standard presentation. Every edition of the Homelessness Marathon features that. So I encourage you to check out the website and download some of the archive. It's there, it's available, and it's 14 hours every year for the last 8 years, so do your multiplication and listen to all those hours. There you go.
So we have just 5 to 10 minutes for questions and discussion. Anyone had reflections to share?
Why
January, February, because it's past that time of like everybody donate, right? Like the period for, you know, giving to any kind of charitable organization starts in